DW Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
Today on the programme, white slums in South Africa.
They are being punished for what has happened in apartheid. Many people call it reverse apartheid. There's no apartheid, but yes, being in poverty does segregate you from the rest of the population.
Making birth safer in Kibera, Kenya. And giant benches bring joy and tourists to northern Italy.
Noi con i bambini ci andiamo, ad esempio, no?
We go with the kids. Friends come and we take them. If people ask us what's special about our area, we say the benches. They make you dream.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn, Germany. South Africa has a long history of discrimination and apartheid. When white colonists and later the white ruling class skimmed the riches of the country to the disadvantage of non-white South Africans. Black townships, the slums of the poor, became the synonym for the unjust system and also symbols for resistance to apartheid. Today, the tables have turned, yet for millions of black South Africans, the dream of a better life after apartheid did not come true. Many continue to live in dire poverty. To balance this, current governmental policies have long been giving priority in getting jobs and receiving benefits to non-whites. But there is a group that seems to lose out. Poor white people. Thousands of families live in South Africa's white slums. Our reporter, Vanessa da Rocha, met some of them. The presenter is Natalie Muller.
The child who is singing lives in Munsiville, one of the thousands of townships or slums in South Africa. Her name is Chegotatso. She's standing in the mud with bare feet in front of her family's shack. She's too young to understand that the song she sings was written for Nelson Mandela, the icon of the struggle for equality between blacks and whites in South Africa. And it's the equality that black people have struggled so hard to achieve in the past that today's whites are claiming now. Because poor white people in South Africa are discriminated against, says Lee Dupree. She's the director of the NGO South African Family Relief Project.
We have children, white children, that were born in a so-called rainbow nation, free and fair democracy since 1994. But these children are being persecuted against because of the color of their skin. Their parents cannot find jobs. These children are living in poverty. They are being punished for what has happened in apartheid. Many people call it reverse apartheid. There's no apartheid, but yes, being in poverty does segregate you from the rest of the population.
Between the 1950s and 1994, racial segregation was institutionalized in the country with the apartheid system. White people had much better educational and economic opportunities. They were better off than non-whites, and many still are. Black and coloured people, which make up 90% of the population, were oppressed, and even today, the majority are still poor. To try to compensate for this inequality, the South African government has prioritised blacks in the labour market and in social programmes over the last two decades. For Lee Dupree, that explains the increase in the number of marginalised white South Africans living in slums.
We have many, many white people in poverty because of the laws that have been put in place in South Africa prohibiting white South Africans from employment. The BBEE law is the broad-based Black Economic Empowerment Law, which clearly states that a company must employ at least 75% black people before they can employ a white person. And then before the white person, the Indian person will get preference before a white person. So the white people are right at the bottom when it comes to employment.
There's no consensus on the number of whites living in poverty in South Africa. Assistance institutions estimate 400,000 people, while the government puts the number at some 40,000. Across the country, around 12 million people are considered poor. That's half of the South African population. some of the impoverished whites began to occupy land irregularly in the late 1990s. The small settlements grew into slums that today are called white squatter camps. Like Munsiville, many of these white slums are concentrated on the outskirts of Johannesburg, the country's main economic centre. Munsiville used to be a black township, but in 2015 white families started squatting right next to it. Today some 300 people live in the white part of the slum that's called Pango Camp. Walking through, the smell of paraffin hangs in the air. There's no electricity. People usually cook on open fires or makeshift fireplaces built from old tin containers. Food needs to be consumed instantly because there's no refrigeration. Families live in tiny tin shacks with little more than simple beds, a few clothes, and some kitchen items. Rain makes things more difficult. Everything gets wet and the paths get muddy. Unemployment is also a huge problem in the slums. Resident Stephanie Jensen says her husband has been looking for a job for 8 years.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very difficult for our white people to get a job these days. It's very, very difficult. My husband goes every day and he goes looks for scrap, and then he goes to the scrapyard, and every money that we get, we put in for food. It's not much that we are getting, but it's at least something for food for at night, because we go day by day, surviving day by day, you see. So all the money that we get during the day, like every day, it goes in the house, like for food and paraffin and candles.
Candles are vital for the Ianson family because they don't have other lights. Like their neighbours, the family cooks on an open fire on the ground. Water is also a big problem. There are only 5 public taps in the settlement to supply hundreds of people. Women queue up to carry water home in buckets every day. Without sanitation and clean water, residents often get sick. Willie Britz, an elderly man who's been living here for several years, is wary of asking for medical assistance. He says that in emergencies, ambulances often aren't willing to serve the slum residents.
When you phone the ambulance, you're waiting very, very long. They don't come out here. If you don't take him to hospital by yourself, it's very bad.
Walking around the white squatter camp at noon, you won't smell anyone cooking lunch. Most people can only afford to eat twice a day, in the morning before the children go to school and at night. Many families depend on food donations from NGOs or other organisations. Only those with children or older people receive some money from the state, around $30 a month. The little money most families live off here comes from selling recycled materials picked up from the garbage. A lot of it goes into paying children's school fees. The hardships facing white township residents are similar to those of black slum dwellers like Rafiwa Mbengwa in Munsiville. He's worried about the impact the problematic economic situation will have on his child's education.
Look the future for my child, because she don't have money to carry. How is she going to be understanding at the school? Understand the school, there is so much other stuff, but she can't reliable on that stuff. You must be free. You can ask even the teacher, what is that? What is that? But how are you going to ask the teacher, but you didn't even eat? Where are you going to get money to eat? Because we're struggling to get the job. We are not safe on this place. Look the road here. This is a danger place, very danger place. What about the child? It's that place. We're struggling on this place. We need better life.
Rafiwa lives in a tin shack right next to the white squatter camp. He's 32 and he and his wife have a child to provide for. Like his white neighbours, he's also been unable to find employment. He says in the past 6 years he's left his home every single day to look for a job, but in vain. And he's frustrated.
If I'm still staying on this place, I don't think my child is going to be a future. Why I'm saying that? Because there's no job around. No houses around. Which means now to my baby, I think my family also is going to be poor like me. Me is now I'm struggling. I can see the government has nothing to do for us.
Only half of the estimated 12 million people living in poverty in South Africa qualify for government assistance. More than a quarter of people of working age are unemployed. For political analyst Thomas Blaser, the reason for the lack of jobs is not skin colour.
Of course, for everyone it's hard to find a job if you have so much unemployment. There are like twice, three, four, five times as many poor black people looking for jobs. But in South Africa, really, everything is about always, you know, what race are you? So everything happened to you because either you're black, you're white, you're colored or whatever. But sometimes it's also other reason, you know, it's not the only reason.
South Africa's Labour Department says it has a strategy to increase jobs in the country and that current employment policies are still needed to help groups that were marginalised in the past. For Blaza, it's not a problem to be solved by the government alone. He says rich white South Africans who benefited during the apartheid regime should take responsibility too.
If you look a bit closer, you will see that between the very rich Afrikaners who make millions of dollars, you know, very rich people, they basically said, we no longer gonna take care of working class white people. There is a lot of animosity from actually from working class white people against the white elite, because the white elite just said, okay, we no longer are responsible for you. Now you have to fend for yourself, because those with a lot of money are doing very well.
South Africa is the biggest economy in Africa, yet half the population continues to live in poverty. Along with addressing unemployment and inequality, more still needs to be done to achieve the goals Nelson Mandela envisioned for all South Africans.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an idea for which I hope to live for and to see realized.
If people have barely enough to survive, healthcare is always an issue. And that's also the case when it comes to babies and maternal health. Aisha Juma has helped more than 100 babies come into the world in Africa's biggest slum. The 35-year-old works as a midwife in Kibera on the outskirts of Nairobi. Aisha has learned her skills from her mother and grandmother, and she knows a lot. The women in Kibera trust her more than the doctors in the badly equipped hospitals. And her great assets are her experience and her hands. She can even tell whether the pregnant women will have a baby girl or boy, as she told Antje Diekans. The report is voiced by Neil King.
Habari zenyu?
Nzuri.
Kwa kina pipi kuna watu?
Eh.
Sawa.
Aisha Juma is on her way to see a patient. Wearing a long black and yellow dress with an African print, the midwife squeezes her way down the narrow paths between the huts of Kibera. The slum is the biggest in Africa. More than 100,000 people live here. And in this part, amidst the sprawling poverty, almost everyone knows Aisha. She has already helped around 100 children into the world. Now she is visiting a mother who gave birth a few weeks ago. Hello, can I come in? She calls. There are three beds in this tiny hut, along with a few plastic stools and a well-worn sofa. Little three-month-old Faisa doesn't like visitors. Aisha, who's 35 and herself a mother of three children, calms the crying baby.
I have to follow up about this child because of the way the child came out. So I have to make a point to follow up to see how the child is doing. So most of the time when I move around, maybe I'm going to visit anybody, but I'll have to pass here and ask her, how is my daughter, how she's doing?
Faisa is Hadija Saidi's 10th child, but during this birth there were complications.
So I could see that she was doing all her best, but the kid could not come. It's like, so I decided just, you know, just put your middle finger inside. So when I put, because the head was almost out, but it's not coming out. So when I put in my middle finger, I figured out that the umbilical cord has gone round the neck of the child. So I had to put in my fingers, try to untie the umbilical cord so that to free the child to come out.
But the little one is doing well. She's developing magnificently. The mother had some of her 10 children at the hospital, some with a midwife.
I don't like hospitals. The difference in a hospital is that the doctor isn't always with you. That's how one of my children almost died there. So I decided never to go there again. I had seven of my children with Aisha and her mother.
The standards at the public hospitals in Kenya are far removed from those in Germany. It's better in private clinics, but the women from Kimbera cannot afford them. Child mortality is high, as is the number of mothers who die during childbirth. In 2013, the Kenyan government decided that both pre- and postnatal care should be free in public hospitals. But hospitals were not adequately equipped and so could not cater to the growing demand. Midwives like Aisha and her mother are in high demand and enjoy a good reputation among the people living in the slum. The pair greet patients in the corrugated roofed home of Aisha's mother. Hens run around the hut. The older midwife is known by everyone in Kibera as Nyanya, or grandmother. She is 70 years old, a strong woman with a wrinkled face.
The first baby I delivered alone was in 1972. This child is now a fully grown mother, and I even helped deliver her child too.
Aisha learned early from her mother. The youngest in her large family, she was the only one interested in becoming a midwife.
First, when I was still schooling, sometimes the patients will come and she has nobody to help. You know, sometimes you need to help maybe in holding the backside of the patient just to help her in the pushing, just to put her in that position. So I will see what she was doing.
One mother even died giving birth with them, and there have been children who didn't make it into the world alive. It's not just the mother who suffers when a baby is stillborn. It takes a toll on the midwives too. Aisha is training to care for mother and child as best she can.
I even have a government certificate from Cultural and Heritage for traditional birth attendant.
It is in the early morning and the afternoon when there is the most action at the midwife's hut. Women come by for a consultation and particularly for a massage. The midwives take 100 shillings from each patient, less than a euro. A birth costs around 25 euros. 32-year-old Latifa Minayo is expecting her fourth child. For her, it's not even a question of whether she will go to hospital.
It's better with a midwife. She really takes care of you. After giving birth, she massages you with warm water and looks after the child. She gives you something to eat so that you can gather your strength again. I feel cared for, as if by a mother. Very different to a hospital.
The expectant mother stretches out on a bed and Aisha massages her stomach carefully. She is concerned about the slim woman, now in her fifth month. The massage should relax the mother, and Aisha can at least ensure that everything is going well with the child, she says. How big it is, whether it's in the right position, and not only that.
By touching the belly, I'll know the age of the pregnancy. I can even detect the sex of the child.
Naturally, only when the mother really wants to know, and Latifa does. It will be a girl, says the midwife. Whether she's right or not, the parents will know when the baby is born, in about 4 months.
Neil King had that report by Antje Dikans on a midwife in Kibera, Kenya.
Countryside, in a far community, in every corner of this land, my brothers are there. They work in a marketplace, they teach in a primary school. Other brothers of this land, my sisters are there, with their hands burnt by the sun. They struggle digging a well to drag the lives right.
To end the show today, we're going to explore a little bit what it's like to feel like children again. At least, that's what many people say when they climb the giant benches in northern Italy. They are 5 times bigger than normal benches, so big they look fit for giants. And if you sit on top, it's a pretty special perspective. The giant benches erected in the hilly Piedmont region are a non-profit project that bring in tourists, but also give local people and their families a chance to enjoy beautiful spots in the area. Dani Mitzmann climbed some of the giant benches and met the men who designed them. And she discovered why the project has invigorated the community spirit.
At the highest point in the small town of Dogliani, the two-tone giant bench has a red iron frame and wooden planks painted turquoise to match the colour of the church dome. Raffaella, her husband, her sister and all four of their kids have just climbed up to sit side by side. And there's still plenty of space on the end for me to join them.
How many benches have you climbed on until now? How many colours have you been on?
Quella rossa, quella blu, quella d'oro, d'oro, e questa.
The red one, the blue one, the purple, the yellow, the gold one. The kids say they've played on quite a few of the benches in the region. The giant benches are an unusual sight on some of the most picturesque hillsides of Piedmont. They're about 5 times higher and wider than normal size. The design is iconic park bench, horizontal wooden seat planks and an iron frame with an elegant curlicue between the front and back legs. But when you climb up to sit on one, with your legs dangling below you, the bench's outsized proportions make you feel like a small child again, able to perceive the world around with fresh delight.
The idea behind the Big Bench Community Project was to try and give something back to the communities. We pay attention to where they're put. We try to make sure that they're not aggressive contextually.
American-born Chris Bangle is the man behind the project. He moved to the tiny Piedmontese village of Clavesana in 2009, waving goodbye to a 17-year career as chief of design for BMW in Germany. Fed up with designing cars for the elite, he wanted to create something more inclusive and more in tune with nature. The following year, he and his wife began the project. The giant benches all offer spectacular views and, most importantly, they're freely accessible by the public. It's a simple idea which has been a resounding success with locals like Raffaella and her family.
If I have to define it, Chris has brought positive energy because he's taught us to love the place we live in and to see it through different eyes.
No profit and privately funded, one of the project's aims is to increase social interaction and economy-boosting tourism. And it's working. This village party for bench fans is full of enthusiastic supporters like Francesco. When he helped his new American neighbour Chris build the very first big red bench 6 years ago, he didn't realise what a huge impact it would have on the area.
Una grossa novità perché mai più avremmo pensato di vedere.
It's a great novelty. We'd never have imagined something new like this here. We are traditionalists to the bone, but the locals accept this well. And it brings loads of people here, so it's a good thing for everyone. A bit of youth in this village full of elderly folk.
Most locals of all ages feel the same way.
Sì, decisamente. C'è molto più via vai. C'è molta più gente, molte più facce nuove in giro, molto più.
Yes, I really like them. There's much more life here, more people, more new faces. I'm a grape grower, and I see people pass by my vineyard and they stop to say hello. They start by asking where the benches are, but that leads to a real interest in the place, which gives us great pleasure and satisfaction with what we do. It fills us with pride.
Noi coi bambini ci andiamo, ad esempio, no? Vengono degli amici, li portiamo.
We go with the kids. Friends come and we take them. If people ask us what's special about our area, we say, the benches. They make you dream. And it's true, you return to the feeling of being a child.
Although some locals are indifferent about the project, they agree the benches are good for business.
Io c'ho la trattoria.
I own the local trattoria.
and people come to eat and have a coffee, so it's good for us. We live nearby, but we haven't ever been to see them.
Chris is taking me to the original big red bench, located just behind his home and studio next to a vineyard.
We are sitting on the very first bench here, way up above the most spectacular view. This was actually really hard for me to climb up on. I had to really yank my foot up. I'm quite small.
Hey, believe me, even if you're very tall, it's still a yank.
But this one has a wooden stump. Do they all have a stump like that to climb up?
Everybody does it differently. Sometimes it's a half a barrel. Sometimes it's nothing. You know, it's like, good luck. So if you're not gymnastic enough, forget it. Ciao. Ti lascio spazio? Okay. We have visitors here. È un po' sporco, ma qui è pulito. Sei da solo?
Hello. Where are you from?
From Venice.
Are you doing a tour of the benches?
Yes. This is the second bench.
On a sunny weekend, Chris says they may get as many as 200 visitors in a single day. But the benches aren't only a tourist attraction.
The people in the local towns here all know these benches. They come here all the time. It's really cute when you find the young couples that come at night on a moonlit night. It's just gorgeous. This is another thing I think is kind of important about these benches, that it gives young people a place to go. Sometimes you just need a place to get away and talk. And I think the benches also offer that for them. One night I ran into a bunch of kids, young guys going down to the bench, armed with a whole bunch of six packs of beer. And just spontaneously I said, be careful and bring the bottles back, right? And they said, well, every time we go to the bench with our beer, we bring the bottles back. I said, every time? You mean like you do this a lot? And this is a really wonderful thing. The people take it very responsibly, and that's a nice thing. And I guess there's an identity with it. People, they want to have a bench because they want to belong to that community. It's probably one of the reasons why we get all these requests.
There are already benches in neighbouring regions, although so far they're all in northern Italy. One of the most popular of the 19 benches built so far is the big white bench in the village of Vezza d'Alba, about 40 kilometres from Clavesana. It sits next to a tower known as the Torrione, at the top of a steep hill overlooking the village. Three generations of locals are here enjoying a picnic on the bench and at the matching white picnic table behind it.
We got together to do something for our village, to attract people and stimulate trade and tourism.
Alessandro is a member of the Torrione Association, a group of local entrepreneurs and their friends.
It works really well. When you look up from the bottom of the hill, you'll always see someone sitting on it. Every moment of the day, morning, afternoon, evening, in every season. It's brought a lot of tourism and we're very pleased with it.
The Lange area may soon be as famous for its giant benches as for its fine red wines. And perhaps their popularity will see a simple local project becoming national or even international. Danny Mitzman, DW, Piedmont.
That wraps up today's edition of WHO World in Progress. If you'd like to listen to this or past episodes again, just go to dw.com/worldinprogress. You can also find us on iTunes or on SoundCloud. Just go to DW English there. Thanks for tuning in. From all of us here in the studio here in Bonn, Germany, Eliane Giaducci and Erhard Bürger. I'm Anke Rasper and this was World in Progress. Take care. Jackie dice no.